This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Deborah Spark, author of the novel Discipline.
Well, I'm always interested in those questions where there really isn't a right answer, but there seems like such moral consequences either way. You know, it seems so wrong not to say, and it's so wrong to say.
We'll be back with Deborah Spark after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Deborah Spark, author of 5 novels, including Unknown Caller, Good for the Jews, and The Ghost of Bridgetown. She has also published 2 collections of short stories and 2 books of essays on fiction writing called And Then Something Happened and Curious Attraction. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Esquire, among other publications. She lives in Maine and teaches at Colby College and the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College. Her new novel, Discipline, takes place over several decades and brings characters together who seem at first to have no connection. Reggie Rupo is living in a foster home as a teenager and one day gets called out of class for punishment for acting out. He gets sent to a rehabilitative high school that uses abusive methods to try to help troubled youth. Eventually, he ends up living with Lisa, the daughter of a famous artist named Jay Morrison. Decades later, Gracie Thomas, an art appraiser, is dealing with her own troubled teenage son and is called to a remote Maine island to assess the art collection of a wealthy resident. When Gracie arrives at the collector's house, the paintings she is most interested in appraising have vanished, and they are by the artist Jay Morrison. We began our discussion with how Spark started writing Discipline.
So I was working on a book about the soup kitchen that honestly wasn't going anywhere. And at the same time I was doing that, I was writing for Shelter magazines. I write for a magazine called Maine Home and Design. So I was lucky enough to go kind of all over Maine and see all these beautiful homes and go to all these beautiful places. So a lot of times I was thinking sort of about the haves and have nots in Maine, you know, on a daily basis. But I had this soup kitchen idea and I was pursuing it, but it wasn't really getting anywhere. And then I was told basically 2 stories that really, really sparked my interest. One was when I was interviewing homeless people who used the soup kitchen. One man told me he was the adopted son of Walt Kuhn, who was one of the artists who was responsible for the 1913 Armory Show that brought modernism to the United States. But the main connection is that he summered in Maine. And he had a, you know, both storied career. You'll see his, you know, paintings all over the place in museums here, but I remember being out in Minneapolis and seeing a bunch of his paintings. He painted clowns, which makes you think of, you know, Bad Things on Velvet, but they were good clowns. They were interesting clowns, even though I'm not a clown person. Towards the end of his life, he was mentally ill, though, and he, I think his wife, who, you know, he quite loved, and his daughter, he also quite loved, I think were forced to put him into a sanatorium. But she did indeed adopt this homeless man. I thought the homeless man was telling me a story, like, that doesn't sound right. But she did indeed adopt him when he was a teenager. But then I heard a bunch of mixed up stories. I went home actually and looked online. I was like, I wonder if that's true. And I saw a sign about a man who was running from the police and he burnt 2 of Walt Kuhn's paintings by the side of the road. And since I'm married to a painter, it made me gasp. To me, it was like burning a novel, but, you know, where you didn't have another copy by the side of the road. I was like, oh my goodness. So that, I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then at the same time, I was reading from my last novel at a library and someone in the audience said, what are you working on next? I mentioned the soup kitchen book. I said, you know, I was volunteering there once a week. And then someone else said, oh, were you then there the night that Patty so-and-so died? And I said, no, but people did die in the soup kitchen bathroom. They overdosed. So then we start talking about this woman, Patty, who she really, really loved, but was aware that she was troubled and that she had fallen back into a heroin addiction. That's what killed her. But she was convinced the reason she died is because she was so traumatized from going to this school called Elon. And Elon, which I had never heard of, but as she starts to describe it, it was a therapeutic boarding school. It's 15 miles from my home, and it operated up until, I believe, 2011. And I've lived in Maine since 1995. I was like, how had I never heard of it? And it was just down the road. So she had said she had gone down a rabbit hole learning about the place. I went down a rabbit hole learning about the place. And into this sort of mess of stuff, I realized that the nonfiction book I couldn't write could turn into a novel I could write, partially because we put art in, that art is something I know. I mean, visual art is something I know, and that there was a way to write this haves and have-nots of Maine by using aspects of both of these stories.
And this was a soup kitchen in Portland, Maine. And was it a difficult process for you to let that go and go into the fiction?
I was relieved, honestly. I wasn't relieved insofar as people have been very kind to me. They don't, and generous in sort of giving me access to various places to talk. And I felt guilty insofar as I felt responsibility to them to write that book. But I just wasn't writing a good book. So no, I felt really relieved. It almost felt like, you know, sometimes if you say to a kid, you don't actually have to do your homework. You know, that's what it felt like. Oh, I don't have to do my homework. I mean, I assigned it. I don't have to do it. It just didn't seem my skill set. And also, you know, that story would have drastically changed by the time, if I had written it, by the time the book came out, because COVID so changed the setup of the soup kitchen, right? They started delivering meals instead of having people come to one place. And just everything. I had stopped volunteering by before COVID anyway. So whatever changes it went through, I didn't see personally.
Do you think you knew that you should have let it go earlier, but you just weren't listening to that little voice inside?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like I was always a good student. You know, like if you're a good student, you're like, someone told you to do the homework. You do the homework. I was like, you told you to do the homework. You're not the best teacher in the world. Get out of here. You know, I felt such a moral obligation to cover the issue. It's an upsetting issue. I mean, the way I was going to do it, I thought was going to be fun, but which was, I had this idea of writing a book like Omnivore's Dilemma, where you trace back, in that book, Michael Pollan traced back where all the food came from three different meals. And I thought, I don't want to do three meals. I want to do one meal and just figure out who's in the room and then trace back their histories. Like, how did everyone get here? But I couldn't really do it. I mean, I had the conceit, but there was sort of no way for me to do it. And there were a lot of people who didn't want to talk to me. So I was also running up against that. And I'm not, you know, I don't really have the personality to go back when someone says no, which I think a real journalist would do, you know, go back and say, well, okay, you said no last week. What about this week? And I just, and then there were certain things I was aware I needed to go into some homeless encampments and other places, which at the time I felt nervous about. I don't know if I'd feel nervous about now, but I just didn't feel like I was quite courageous enough to write it.
It's interesting, though, because I think that was a necessary part of your journey. You were just labeling it as the wrong thing, and partly because you just didn't know yet. Like, that research was probably essential for the book you finally wrote. But
I do think so.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a homeless character, you know, who's a fiction, but he, you know, he's a blend of people I met researching that book.
So it is not wasted.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your interest in art as a central theme. You know, Gracie, the art appraisal, one of the central questions of her life, which she says, basically, the narrator says, is like, what use is beauty? She's thinking like when people are really struggling and there's wars or strife, basically, or homelessness or whatever, like what good is beauty? And I think that was also a central question of the book.
Yeah. And I think it's a central question of my life. So so my twin sister is always been in anti-poverty work. She was in homelessness for forever. And now she does stuff for the environment. And I'm aware that I don't do something good in that way, like in a direct way. I mean, yes, yes, yes. You could say, oh, you're helping people appreciate fiction. And, you know, if you help people appreciate fiction, you know, reading fiction makes you more empathetic. And, you know, you can say all that, which I believe to be true. But I do also have the thoughts that that character does. You know, it's like, okay, I want to be a better person. I want to improve the world, make the world a better place. And yet I am devoted as a person who writes novels, or I'm working on nonfiction now, but you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I'm directly except for maybe those days I was, you know, scooping food in the soup kitchen, I'm not directly helping people. You know, I write a check to this cause and that cause. So to have a whole life that is devoted really to beauty, as the character does, or as I would say my husband does, I mean, he's a painter, I think it sort of puts you in a sort of interesting relationship to your own ethics. And it's hard, at least for me, not to, I mean, it's not like I'm going to turn around and not be what I am. That's the path I went down. But I, you know, I do wonder about it. And I actually wonder about it sometimes when people start to get very spiritual in the way they talk about art. And it's not that I don't believe it, because I do, but sometimes I think people get almost too grandiose for art. And it makes me think of, it was a very famous Solzhenitsyn speech. Do you know his Nobel speech? Do you know that? He sort of talks about people saying things like, you know, art will save us, you know, basically art will save us. And then he's like, wait a second, you know, this isn't a direct quote, but a more or less quote from Solzhenitsyn, when in the bloodthirsty history of mankind has art ever saved anyone from anything? I mean, that's basically his question in his Nobel Prize speech. And then he does actually almost work it around to say art does save people. But I think that is part of my question. You know, you look at the present moment, of course, it's like, yeah, I don't think art is going to get us out of the, you know, Middle East situation, or, you know, solve Ukraine and Russia, which isn't to say that actually the art that comes out of that is so important for the people who are suffering that. But, you know, I jump through hoops in my own mind when I'm thinking about what I'm doing.
Did writing this book, that in part, not wholly, is an investigation of that?
Just in part. And the only reason, like, I would think, like, in terms of this, did this book do any good? I think it's probably good to re-expose what happened at Elon. I mean, I set it at a fictional place up on the border instead of where it actually happened. But, you know, that place was horrible. And in fact, I had a shocking walk with a friend the other day who it turned out had worked there for 5 weeks when she was a young woman. And she told me this story. I was like, oh my God, it was so shocking. And to me, it's amazing those people didn't go to prison for some of the stuff they did. I mean, there was stuff they should have been punished, you know, and there were long-term, very negative impacts on the alums who came out of there. I mean, I think some alums, it did help. I think some alums, it was a way of sort of pushing them into obeying rules that did work for them. But I think for a lot of people, it was traumatizing.
Yeah, in your book, when Reggie goes there, well, first, when they get there, they have to sing Mary Had a Little Lamb in front of everybody, which is very strange. We never really learn why, and they aren't told why. And they have like a hierarchy, like a caste system, where if you're on the lowest rung, you're like cleaning toilets with a toothbrush, and you can't even speak until you get a few rungs higher.
Rungs up.
When someone has some kind of outburst, they do things like put you in a boxing match with people where there might be two against one, and they keep rotating more people out to fight you. Or there's something they do where they pour stuff over your head that has like human feces and like all this stuff in it.
Yeah.
They have group therapy. Like, it's almost like this warped, like clockwork orange sort of reality.
Yeah. You know, except for the nursery rhyme, that all happened. There's that. About 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, an alum of the program did do a documentary. It's not even quite a full hour, where he both documents a lot of that and then goes back and talks to various people who were there. And some of the people who worked there as well, who are still alive. Some of those people aren't alive anymore. It was part of the scared straight thinking, you know, and in fact, before this documentary, back in, I'm guessing the 70s, I don't know, there was a episode of 60 Minutes where they covered this place and two other places that were similar. And, you know, it's not like you completely can't see what was behind the ethic, which was a somewhat of a scared straight or out bully the bully. You know, and some of these people were bullies, you know, and needed to be out bullied, I guess. And I think the way it was presented to parents was, you know, it's the last stop. It's here or death. It's here or prison for your kids. So I think that's how some people got there. But quite frankly, like this woman I was walking with the other day, the guy who ran it was nuts, you know, and he really nuts, you know, a sort of sociopathic narcissist. He himself had been cleaned up by being sort of scared straight. So I think he believed his own rhetoric, but he had no clinical education or knowledge. And they had brought in a Harvard trained clinician who should have known better and who was making millions off of this. So it was a cash cow for, you know, the adults at the top. And then the people directly dealing with the children were sometimes just people, or often, who had just aged out of the program themselves. So they've been brought up in this way of getting people to behave, but there was no empathy. There was no other understanding. There wasn't, you know, kindness.
Yeah. And your character, Reggie, who goes there, he was a lost soul, but he was kind, and they were trying to like take the kindness out of him when he was supposed to berate someone or hit someone he didn't want to, but there was no choice for him. I mean, he ended up getting like the shit beat out of him. And finally was able to get away. And then he meets Lisa, the daughter of the artist, and she just takes him in, and he becomes quite loyal to her, and he lives with her for a while and starts to learn about this art. And then he learns a big secret about the art. And because he's really kind, he's really struggling with what is the kind thing to do for Lisa. And I'm curious about that question in general, like morally, and your inclusion of that in the book, because this secret would have changed her life and it would have changed a lot of people's perception of her father's art. And he decided not to tell her. And is that always the kind thing? And curious about this conundrum you put in the book.
Well, I'm always interested in those questions where there really isn't a right answer, but there seems like such moral consequences either way. You know, it seems so wrong not to say, and it's so wrong to say. And also, I feel like he needs a mother. You know, he really needs a parent, and she really needs a child in a certain way. I mean, they really need each other. And yet, I think, you know, he's aware she's a stranger who's just, she has the financial means to take care of him, but, you know, why is she even doing it? I mean, it's sort of puzzling even to him. And yet he can't question it too much because he's just completely without, you know, any sort of network, because he's frightened to, not that there wasn't much of a network at home, but he did, you know, have a friend who he left, but, you know, there's nowhere to support him. And he's still so scared that the people from Adelaide, which is what I call the school, are going to somehow find him. So, but I was interested in it also as a question that could go for some time, because it's a question, I think, even before the conundrum gets set up, when the secret sort of first gets established, whether it's the right or wrong thing to do. I mean, I think from a sort of classical perspective, oh, it's wrong, you know, it involves a lie, it involves deception. And then I always think art always involves deception, doesn't it? Right? Art is deception. But it's a sort of deception done for a sort of practical purpose and with everyone's agreement, but it's still a deception, or everyone's agreement who's immediately affected. So I think it's sort of interesting, even when it gets established, whether it was the right or wrong thing to do for the people who do it. And then that it becomes an issue even many years later when, you know, the characters from the various narrative lines meet up and have to confront it.
What do you mean by art is always kind of a deception?
Well, actually, I have a previous book also with Fourway where all the stories are about art and deception. And I just thought, oh, it's so easy to put an art story with deception and art, because it is, you're making things up in the case of narrative art, or you're putting something on the wall that isn't, you know, is not an object, it's a version of an object. You know, I just feel like art is a kind of deceit, and, you know, not a negative deceit in some ways. So I often like stories where art and deception go together. I sometimes wonder if that's why people like art and crime stories so well. You know, art crime always makes people excited. And I thought, well, why is that? And is it just because it's something valuable or sort of sexy with, you know, the sort of narrative thrill of a crime? Like, I was thinking of, there was a French series called Lupin. And, it opens with a heist in the Louvre. So of course it's big money and stuff, but there's something about art and crime that, I don't know, people like in a weird way. Maybe also because it doesn't seem to have victims in the exact same way. You know, I mean, you steal a painting, it does have victims, but it doesn't have victims in the same way. But I don't know. There's something about the fact that the painting always wasn't a true thing, right? You know, it was an image of an image, or it's a creation. I mean, I realize deception sounds negative, but, you know, it's a positive deception.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
You mentioned that this is about parenting, and you mentioned about Reggie also wanting a mom. And when we open on Gracie, the art appraiser, having a lot of issues with her teenage son who just doesn't want to get off his screen. And she doesn't like being policed by his mother and being asked. And so she's really struggling. And she asks these questions during the book about, like, do you give him what he wants? Like when you go to the store and you always buy him a Matchbox car, is that the best way to handle that when he's little? Does he learn? What is the best way to parent a young child? Is it giving into their whims when they're little? Do you set something up? So that was an interest in the book.
You know, I'm a parent. So I think, and I feel like a parent in contemporary times, I feel like these are such big issues. And also I wanted, you know, it took me a while to get there. At first, I only knew I wanted all the narrative lines to braid together. And then I was like, oh, they also all need to parallel one another. And actually, in all honesty, in the initial, and this was a huge misstep, in an initial draft of the book, there was all this, there wasn't, Gracie wasn't divorced. She was in a marriage that she was unhappy in. And it was a lot about, she was just struggling in her marriage and there's all this marriage stuff. And the son was there, but not so much so there. But then I thought, you know, you've got this horrifying discipline, right, of the therapeutic school, which is way too far in the controlling and lack of empathy. But I think in our present moment, I wouldn't say we're way too far in the empathy and no restrictions moment, but I think we're so aware of our children's emotions. We're so worried for them. We're so worried about this particular moment in time, about their mental health and other things. So it's just very hard to swear, or always was for me. I mean, I was never going to be inclined to be a strict parent, but, you know, where to draw the line, what is appropriate. And also, you know, I think a lot of children do spend too much time on screens, and then, you know, negotiating with that, them with that, and knowing what's healthy for them and what's not healthy. It's just like hard. I think it's hard to figure out. And especially, you know, if it's their social life, it's their, you know, it's whatever it's providing them with, especially since I'm 61, you know, there wasn't an equivalent for me, you know, that I felt like. It always seems to me the way that young people are with their screens seems addictive to me. And then if you think, oh my goodness, you know, there's addiction in my family. Does this mean this is going to translate into such and such? And I don't think it does, since they sort of almost ubiquitously all use the screens. But I think there's just like a lot of unknowns for a contemporary parent about what the right thing to do is. And I think, especially, you know, because kids are fragile, there's all that much more desire to sort of not restrict or not, you know, to allow. And then, you know, I always think, sometimes I think about, I mean, this isn't in the book at all, but I think about it as a parent, is my younger sister died really young. And I was like, maybe she should have been allowed everything. She wasn't going to get a whole life. You know what I mean? Not, you know, we sort of raise people as if they're going to live forever. You know, we're going to have long lives. And then you think, well, who knows when any of this is going to end? You know, there's a sort of sense that you have to develop these skills for later. Maybe there's not going to be a later. So I feel like that my own parenting would get sort of scrambled with all of these, you know, sort of fears and thoughts. And yet I hold myself to pretty strict behaviors. And so my sort of initial impulse, you know, was to be like, you know, this, and this with my own son. And then, you know, when you have your child come up, you have to deal with the child you have, not the child that you were, or the parenting you had. I wouldn't say my parents were strict, but they were way strict compared to today. But that's mostly because they told us to do stuff. We did it. You know, it was just very different. So I wanted to parallel the different ways of parenting. I mean, their parents were completely absent here, obviously. And then the parental in locus are really horrible at the school. And then, I mean, Gracie just to kind of be kind of lost, you know, because she realizes she's sort of losing her son, over these conflicts, and she doesn't want to lose her son. And yet she's aware of what the right thing to do, while her ex, I think, is, you know, wildly permissive and not doing the right thing. And in that way, winning her son's affection and sort of in some ways stealing him from her, which, you know, is heartbreaking to her.
Is that part of the reason that she's obsessed with finding the stolen paintings? I mean, that is the engine of the plot for much of it. Is she's like, well, they aren't here, so why can't it be me that finds them?
I think part of her, in my head, I connected her desire for the paintings less around her current conundrum with her son than how hard it was for her to have a child. That she liked the woman who was married to the famous painter, miscarried, couldn't have children. So for a long time. And so she wanted children for so long. And she's sort of aware of the paintings as sort of a symbol for a wanted child. So, and then she finds out, oh no, they did have a child. And she herself does have a child. So the sort of drama of pregnancy loss or not, or infertility, is one that sort of falls out of her life. But that sense of, you know, desperately wanting something that isn't forthcoming was sort of projected onto those images. And I think that's why she's attached to them. I think she feels like an emotional feeling she had got put in paint. And then she's interested to see not only that it got put on paint, but that someone, that a man could understand it. That's what she thinks. Because I think, I mean, I don't know if this is fair, but I think a lot of times when women have pregnancy loss, less so maybe than IVF, infertility, which I think both of the couples experience, but the pregnancy loss does play itself out in one person's body, not both people's bodies. So the sense that the male partner would be incredibly empathetic and really, really get it, which is definitely not what happened to Gracie. This is her ex who she went through the pregnancy loss with. I think she's also moved by that connection, that someone could really get it and so get it to somehow articulate it in physical form.
At the heart of this book, there's also an element where women are not empowered to be everything that they can be or actually even are. They're not seen in a certain way. And I'm curious if this was something that you knew you wanted to embed in this novel, or if it came to you over the course of writing.
It came to me, but also Reggie isn't seen too. I mean, I feel like that's important because Reggie has this talent that always, I mean, it does get seen by his family, but there is an important part of Reggie that I think would have bloomed if he had better parenting, right? And it doesn't. And then the people who love him see it, and then Gracie sees it in the end, but it is this important. So I think he doesn't get seen really. I mean, where he ends up working, but in terms of the hidden lives of certain of the women here, I feel, and hopefully less so for present days, you know, I grew up in a generation when a lot of women just were in service to men, you know, or lived their lives in service to the great man, right? In fact, I have this friend, Kate Christensen, and she was my first reader for this book. And she goes, oh, it's like The Great Man. And she actually wrote a book called The Great Man. And it turns out it has a similar secret to my book. But I feel like the way in which the painter, the famous painter in this book is kind of the great man to whom the women in his life do a kind of service is just something I saw growing up. And even I have this dear friend here named Jocelyn Lee. She runs a gallery, or she founded a gallery that is for mid to late career woman specifically. And when she did the lecture where she was presenting the gallery to the community, she talked about the artist she was exposed to when she went to college. And we actually went to the same college and we're in the same year. I was like, yeah, I remember that. And she just puts up one wonderful image after another. And not one of them is of a woman. And I was like, yeah, that's true. We didn't see one woman growing up. I mean, I remember my art history class. I loved my art history class. And it didn't, and we were sort of proto-feminists too then. You know, it wasn't like 1984, which is when I graduated from college. You know, there were women's studies classes, not as many as today, but we're starting to become aware. But it was just like the women were all on the sidelines. And I feel like, so those characters in the book, they're coming up in that era. Not Gracie. I mean, Gracie's coming up in the present. I mean, more or less the present moment. So she has her own career. I mean, it's a career in service to others' art, but I don't think she aspired to something in terms of creating her own art. But it, I think it emerged over time, but maybe emerged just because that's what I saw.
Well, Lisa was another woman. She was kind of an odd character, and I'm sure that was because she grew up with this famous artist and some of the parenting there wasn't great. But yeah. I'm curious about her character. She was alone. She was a woman who was really dedicated to the art of her father, and that became her life's path. So in a way, she didn't have her own path.
Yeah, in my head, she's a combined version. It's so funny. I see her so clearly of two women I know. And they actually were artists, the real people I'm basing her on, but who always puzzled me. They were the real woman, or maybe I'm seeing Lisa in my head, both dressed like Lisa does, sort of a weird combination of archaic and sexy, like a little off. Both women, I assumed, had eating disorders. Both women were really kind, really generous, and really private. And you couldn't quite get a line on them. Someone asked me why her point of view isn't in the story. And I thought, oh, because I don't know who she is. I mean, I know how she behaves, but I can't guess what's going on in her head exactly. And it's so in the case of these women, I felt like they were a weird combination of people who had gotten both too much attention and not enough attention, or not the right kind of attention, which accounted for why they were somewhat performative in their garb, but also self-effacing in other ways. And it just sort of interested me again as a sort of female type. And then I also do see, you see these people who grow up, I think, with very famous people who are sort of in a milieu where they're sort of taught that that's the person who matters. So that's the person they need to focus on. When in fact, the other people probably maybe are more interesting. Like in my head, although she's not much in the book, the mother is really interesting of this. Lisa's mother is really interesting. And why Lisa's mother makes the choices she does is really interesting.
Do you want to talk about Maine? You say in there that Mainers have this notion of privacy. That seems important.
Yeah, I used to feel that way a lot, that Mainers, I feel it less now that I've lived here so long, but I thought Mainers were so private, they didn't notice what was going on. That's what I felt, that they, and it was a kindness because, you know, we don't interfere, but I sometimes thought a little interference might make sense here. You know, maybe that would help this one or that one. I don't know if I feel that as much now, but a lot has happened since I had first had that perception. I mean, I love Maine. I think when I first came here, I found it a kind of lonely place because I felt people kept to themselves, but I feel that less and less. And I think maybe because I've changed, but I also think the place has changed. It's gotten more populated, but I also think oddly, the weather, people are out more, you know, it's less cold. The pandemic, I feel like I saw how friendly people were because, you know, the only way people could talk was when they're out for walks. And so
we'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influences you as a writer?
Yeah. Do you know this book, Land of Big Numbers by Tae-Ping Chen? Have you read it?
Yes, I interviewed her on it.
I'm obsessed with her. I'm obsessed with her. I've taught this first story in this book, Lulu, a number of times. So I thought I'd just maybe just read the first paragraph or the first two paragraphs. I'm sure you said this in your interview with her. She was a writer for, I believe, the Wall Street Journal. She's Chinese American, but she lived in China for a while and wrote this book, book of fiction. And as she notes, they can't even read it there, right? No, it's China. I've had Chinese students in my class who've read it, and, you know, it's interesting to see their reaction. But this story, Lulu, it was in The New Yorker, and that's how I first found out about her. The hour of our birth had been carefully forecast, a winter's day cesarean timed to coincide with Dr. Fang's lunch break. The doctor pulled me out first, indignant, squalling, like a hotel guest, inexpertly roused and tossed before checkout. She came next and was so perfectly quiet that at first they worried she wasn't breathing at all. Then they thwacked her on the back and her cries joined mine, and they laid us side by side, boy and girl, two underwater creatures suddenly forced to fill our lungs with cold, dry air. Dr. Fang had operated on my mother as a favor to my uncle, his old classmate. Otherwise, we would have been born in the hospital down the street, where a woman had bled to death after a botched cesarean the previous year. The family had been in the waiting room for hours, and at last the father-to-be pounded on the doors of the operating room. When no one responded, the family pushed them open to find the lifeless woman on the table, blood pooling on the ground. She was alone. The staff had stripped the medical certificates that bore their names from the wall and fled as soon as the surgery went wrong. From the start, we were lucky, not least because we had each other. So it's a really long story, but it's such a beautiful story. And even in those two paragraphs, it sort of gets at the conflict that's going to be in the story, which is these two siblings are very different from one another, and yet they're living within this culture that is corrupt and complicated ways because of the politics of the country. And the story is really about how they both grow and negotiate it, but incredibly, incredibly moving, I thought, and really complicated. And it also reminds me of being told tragedy structure is the rising fortunes of one character meets the falling fortunes of another, which is kind of what this story is about. And then they cross at a certain point. But because it's about twins and I'm a twin myself, it's just really moving how they deal with each other. And that they're kind of because they're in China and in the circumstances there are, they get into an impossible situation because of their separate value systems.
Can you read something that you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft or something you like?
Yeah, I'll just read also from the beginning. My first page changed a lot and I'll read it and then explain why. So this is just the very opening. Something had gone wrong. Gracie Thomas had arrived on the island just when she said she would, on the final ferry of the day, the winter light dimming over the course of the two-hour journey east, and she too preoccupied to enjoy the drama of the ocean, the air too bitterly cold for standing on deck, the filthy windows cloudy with condensation. A more avid lover of the great outdoors would have braved the temperatures, but when Gracie had to choose between the natural world and comfort, she opted for the latter. Camping or a flush toilet, the world's greatest invention, wins in a landslide. By late afternoon, the question of the view was moot anyway, the day dark as midnight. Gracie's mind was back in Boston instead of on the Atlantic, her focus Jeremy, her 16-year-old son, the child whom she'd waited and waited and waited for through 1, 2, 3, 4 miscarriages, the one who was so, so wanted. He had run away from home. "Well, don't call it that," her husband Eric had said the day after it happened. "He's only at his dad's." True enough, except he had refused to return, the 50-50 custody arrangements be damned. 6 weeks had passed since Jeremy had exploded out of her house, an information blackout during which Gracie's ex simply said, "Gracie, if he doesn't want to talk, I'm not going to make him talk." Meanwhile, just yesterday, the school had called asking about Jeremy's frequent absences. Gracie's stomach had clutched. Absences? "Jeremy needs to go to school," Gracie called Weiler to say. "You need to parent him. As if you know anything about..." Gracie hung up. She was not going to go another round with her ex. How could she set things right if she couldn't even talk to Jeremy? And how could she improve things from her current locale? She had noticed as the ferry took her further and further eastward that she no longer had cell reception.
So tell me more about that.
Well, I always knew I wanted that to be the first scene, her arriving on the island. But what's different is originally her son had not run away from home. And now it's such an important part of the book. Like, it's the cover is of a boy running away from something. So that was a big, big change. And I think I said it earlier, but I feel like for a long time, you know, I always knew I wanted my three narrative lines to braid together, but I don't think I realized how important it was that they parallel one another as well. And I feel like figuring that out, which seems now so basic to the book, that they need to be thematic. I mean, I knew they need to be thematically of a piece in other ways, but that they needed to be thematically a piece in terms of what was going on with the parent-child relationships, that came late, or came late for this particular narrative line, which had, as I said, been about a troubled marriage. And that, I mean, there is a troubled marriage insofar as the character's divorced, but that marriage is largely off the page. She's in a happy marriage now, and the tension is all with how she communicates with her son.
Where do you write?
Right where I am now, in front of my computer.
What do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
So I live in Maine, and I just go for a walk outside or exercise, swim laps, go to the lake, swim, go for a walk, exercise mostly.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
My husband. And even though he's not a writer and he's not a big reader, he will listen to me read it out loud. And I always hear stuff anyway. If I read it out loud, I'm like, how did I not catch this? But he's sort of like a bullshit detector, which is terrible. He doesn't even give me feedback. His face just crinkles. He's like, what? And then I get a little defensive, but I know he's always right. He's like, that doesn't make any sense. I was like, okay. And then, so he's my first. And then I have two really, really dear friends who I've been with, a sort of writer's group for many, many years, and we share work.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Badly. I confess this to a few people, but I have in my email box a little folder called Ego Saves. And if someone says something nice to me about my work in an email, I'm like, that's going into the Ego Saves. So if I get a lot, it's like, if there's stuff that makes me upset, I was like, and it's time to read something in the Ego Saves. So that's been one thing, the Ego Saves folder. And also, I just think as I get older, I put it more in perspective. When I was younger, a big thing I would do is try to make another opportunity for myself. So if something wasn't working out, I would try to find something that would work out.
What is your favorite word?
Right now, my favorite word is oi, only because it's such a terrible time in history. And I feel like every day deserves an oi because, you know, you open the newspapers, oi, you know, so that is my favorite word right now. But I was thinking about it. Maybe it's my favorite word also because if you flip it around, it can be yo, right? So, which I noticed there was a oi in front of the Brooklyn Museum some years ago. And I was like, oh, it's a yo too. So it's like if you face Crown Heights, it's oi. And if you face, I don't know, the other part of Crown Heights, it's yo. So I thought, yo is better than oi. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation.
Thanks, Mitzi.
You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look for First Draft, ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Steve Almond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft a dialogue on writing a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.